Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
If you look at human history, really, one of the things that makes the biggest difference to our way of life is medicine, is coming up with treatments, is breakthroughs that change public health and really make it possible to live longer and better. And what an extraordinary amount of progress we've made in the past couple of centuries, really, in understanding what's going on. Things like the germ theory, understanding hygiene, all of the immunizations that have occurred, and the vaccination programs that have saved countless lives internationally. And then even as we speak, the COVID vaccine's being rolled out. But Australia has a pretty impressive record when it comes to medical breakthroughs. And so we're going to explore this and next Monday night on Nightlife, the history of medical breakthroughs in Australia. And to talk us through some of these breakthroughs for Chapter 1, we have with us Dr. Peter Hobbins. He's a historian of science, technology and medicine and an honorary associate of the University of Sydney. Dr. Peter Hobbins, welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be back with you again.
Lovely. And also Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, who is a clinical immunologist. He's a pioneer in a field known as mucosal immunology, which I'll ask him about too. He's also got a book coming out fairly soon called The Long Enlightenment, Australian Science from Its Beginning to the Mid-20th Century. Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be back again, yeah.
Lovely. What is mucosal immunology, by the way?
Well, mucosal immunology is about how the body meets viruses like COVID-19 and how it reacts to them at that first phase. So it's a very important first defense mechanism. And when it goes wrong, it goes terribly wrong, and you can get a whole variety of diseases, or you don't cope with viruses like COVID-19 very well, as people my age don't do so well.
Well, that's we could do a whole hour talking about COVID, but I suspect that that's been done quite a lot. We're looking backwards tonight. So to focus on the positives as we get started, here in Australia, we have a pretty extraordinary quality of life. We're top 10 in the OECD for life expectancy for both men and women, well below the average when it comes to deaths due to things like heart disease, some of the world's highest cancer survival rates. So there's plenty we're doing right. The part of that is our public health system and the way it's provided to all via Medicare. But also, there's two centuries of medical research done here in Australia. And the specialists you see in your hospitals build on that. And so even though we're isolated geographically, we've managed to contribute quite a lot. Let's start with you, Peter. What kind of medical science do you think we do best in Australia? What are our strengths, internationally speaking?
Look, I think if we go back over the last two centuries, Australians have done particularly well in what's often called applied research, which isn't to say that they haven't had brilliant ideas out of the blue or haven't had fundamental insights. But I think partly because we've had a reasonably small population base with a reasonably small funding base, often it means that our researchers have focused on practical problems, you know, whether they're clinical problems or agricultural or veterinary problems. They've had to deal with things because that's where the money is. You know, there's an issue, we need to deal with it, let's have a look at it. And it's often from that the problem is solved, but sometimes from that, the more fundamental insights evolve as well.
So getting hands dirty and trying to solve these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing too, because, you know, research is a process of discovery. You don't know what you're going to find until you actually roll your sleeves up and get in and have a go. And sometimes, you know, you can do some brilliant work, you can pin down the potential causes, you can test various hypotheses and come out with the correct answer. But in other cases, as we'll be hearing in some of our stories tonight, it can take a lot longer, and you've got to be patient, diligent, and have somebody who's willing to support you for a long time. But I think that applied research has really been the mainstay of a lot of Australian medical history success.
Now, Robert, in terms of the areas of research and the medical research that we do here, how much of it flows on from some of the earliest European scientists that we talk about, people like Joseph Banks and James Cook? What's the legacy there?
Well, my view, Tom, is that when Cook and Banks came to Australia, they introduced two broad ranges of science. Cook introduced what I'd call the navigational sciences, the physical sciences, astronomy, mathematics, where Banks introduced natural history. And medical science, in a sense, flows on as part of that natural history component. And I think what Peter has just said is spot on, that what we've done extremely well is cope with challenges. And those challenges in medicine have been, we can go back to epidemics, new diseases, issues really affecting the society of the day. And if you look at the great breakthroughs, I think that's where Australia has contributed so well.
Okay, so this notion of applied research, do you think Peter, that's evolved through choice or seeing a gap, or do you think it's a product of our distance and size?
I think there's a couple of elements there. One is, you know, we're good opportunists. You know, if you can see a chance to deal with a problem or to further your career as a researcher and find ways in, then you can potentially score some quick wins and support not just your own research, but actually the idea of research. And I think that was really important in the late 19th century and in the early part of the 20th century as well, is that Australians could have made major contributions to major diseases like tuberculosis or cancer or heart disease, but they were really global problems and they were big, and you know, we're still struggling to solve many of those today. So I think there was a lot of sensible thinking saying, well, look, actually let's have a look around it, have a look around us at some things like parasites or infectious diseases or the very Australian problem of snake bite, and are there ways that we can actually deal with that with the resources we have on hand? But also, can we work smarter as well? You know, can we focus our energy on dealing with a particular, you know, particular group of patients or a particular outbreak of a disease where we can actually observe all of the variables?
And is that still the case now when you look at the, I guess, the research profile? There's a little bit of a diversion. I was wondering if this is still the case, that applied is the focus and we don't do a lot of the blue sky stuff.
Do you want me to have a go?
Oh, yeah, sure. Please.
Okay.
Thanks, Robert.
I actually think that Peter is spot on. That is how medical research was done, what made our name, what got our Nobel Prizes. But what has happened, I think, is that we've moved a long way away from that. We've become much more focused on grant money, career development, and most of the research today is more on process, how you're doing something but doing it well, not necessarily answering big questions. And I think we've drifted away from that particular focus that has been such a stalwart for us in the past. We're okay. Not looking at the big questions.
Well, Robert, let's look back at that period with the Nobel Prizes. I mean, I was mentioning before that half of the 16 Nobel Prizes that Australians have won have been in the area of health and medicine. The first half of the 20th century was pretty strong in terms of Nobel Prize laureates. What was it about that period that meant that Australians were so prominent on the world stage?
Oh, I think what characterised that period was what characterised the latter part of the 19th century, and that is that Australians across the scene were interested in science. They were attuned to meeting challenges and solving them using scientific method. And so medicine, in that sense, was in many ways a rather late starter in Australia, because health was very similar in Australia to that in England, and so they didn't have that same sort of level of challenge. But when they did, they met... I think that when, for example, we had influenza, which is a very good example, we coped with that extremely well. We had half the mortality as New Zealand or England. We're lucky being an island continent, but we still did extremely well. And out of that came the Hall Institute, Macfarlane Burnet, looking at practical issues. And out of the practical issues came great scientific observations. So someone like Burnet moulded the way in which everyone around the world looked at influenza at every level, from the biology through to vaccine development. But he went on from there and asked basic questions. And I think that's what Peter was alluding to earlier, that there was this connect, if you like, between the practical and the theoretical. And Burnet did this amazing thing. He said in the 1950s, look, we've done all this wonderful virology. Let's turn the other side and look at immunology. And out of that came, of course, the beginnings of cellular immunology and what has made Australia, I think, great across the board in immunology over the last 60, 70 years.
Yeah, we're going to follow a sort of linear structure as we go through these stories. And there are some tales of people seeing that, you know, the connections and things that people didn't notice before, joining dots and so on. But I think we need to just dive further into the case of McFarlane Burnet, because he's such a well-known figure. And I guess talking about cellular immunology is fairly topical in 2020. My name is Dom Knight, by the way. You're on ABC Radio for Nightlife right around the country. And our guests this evening, Dr. Peter Hobbins and Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, talking about medical breakthroughs. Peter, from your perspective, McFarlane Burnet, I mean, for those who aren't familiar with his research into influenza and so on, what did he discover and what was so revolutionary about it?
I guess there's two really critical elements of Burnett's career, and Robert, you know, my old mate Robert just referred to, you know, two of the major strands, virology or the study of viruses, which were very much a brand new thing in the early part of the 20th century, and then immunology, which had been around for a while, but when he really turned his attention to it in the 1950s, he transformed the fundamental understanding of how the immune system works. Now, I mean, so Frank McFarlane Burnet was one of those people who was born in the late 19th century. He was too young to serve in the First World War, but he was a medical student just in the stage of the 1918 and 19 influenza pandemic, and he actually had a mild case of it. He survived, but he definitely remembered the extraordinary and sad impact of that disease. Yeah. And as the 1920s and 30s went on, he became more and more interested in the causes of influenza, which led him into his career in viruses. But as I was saying before, you know, sometimes these very applied problems come up. I mean, he was looking at the very nature of viruses, but at the same time in the 1930s, he was doing research on a disease called psittacosis, which is actually a disease of parrots. And it became an economic problem for Australia because we were exporting large numbers of parrots overseas and many of them were dying from this disease. So he was still doing very applied work in animals at the same time he was developing fundamental ideas about how viruses work.
Isn't it fascinating the way you can be looking at one particular thing that's the kind of linear path you followed and then lightning strikes somewhere completely different. Robert, do you want to add to the yeah. Burnett discussion?
Well, what I can add is that, and you raised the issue of the pragmatic aspect of science and the practical, and Peter's given psittacosis as an example. He was also able to find the organism, which was a very tricky organism, that caused a disease called Q fever, which was a major problem in abattoirs. And this Q fever issue was incredibly infectious. In fact, very sadly, it killed one of his technicians working in the Hall Institute. But he was able to identify the organism, and that led on eventually to people in Australia coming up with the vaccine that is used in abattoirs and people, vets and people at risk of developing this infection from cattle and exposure to various animals. And so Burnet was always had his finger on the practical pulse. In fact, he's the reason I ended up becoming an immunologist.
There you go.
So there you go. He's one of my heroes.
And another zoonotic disease, I guess. So that's fairly
exactly.
Like COVID-19, everything comes back to COVID these days, doesn't it? That's why we're talking about this. It's been so front of mind as the world has done, and it's a really extraordinary job of developing.
It's very hard to get
vaccines.
Away from COVID, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it certainly is. It really is. So just jumping further back and looking at this point that we're coming to, you research something, perhaps, and the economic interest is fascinating too, the parrot industry and, of course, abattoirs and cattle and so on, still a huge business here. I don't know whether parrots are a big export business these days, but if someone knows, send us a text and let us know.
Only illegally, I think.
Yeah, we shouldn't be doing that. Of course, we shouldn't. So, Peter, on your Twitter account, which is at History2Wheeler, you posted about this chat tonight, and you put a photo there. It looks fairly old. It's a derelict little structure attached to the side of a brick building, and there's a young girl in front of it who's holding a baby, it seems. What's this photo, and what's the significance of this to the story?
Yeah, look, the photo's from a wonderful collection at State Archives and Records New South Wales, where it's one of a series of many photos taken of Sydney in the early part of the 20th century of buildings that were about to be disinfected or actually demolished or even burned because of the presence of bubonic plague in the city. So by bubonic plague, I mean the Black Death of the Middle Ages, you know, that quintessential disease that left whole villages, you know, completely empty of living souls and effectively killed about a third of the population of Europe in, you know, so the 14th and 15th century. So on the one hand, we've got this picture of Sydney in 1900, the start of the fabulous 20th century. And on the other hand, it's taken because of this medieval disease landing on our shores.
I would never have thought that bubonic plague came here, you know, as recently as that. I would have thought we were not going to say immune to it, but, you know, isolated, insulated from it. And I guess it's one of the things when we think about quarantine and all of these ways of dealing with things and, you know, you fire as a disinfectant and so on. A lot of these ideas are fairly old in terms of public health, aren't they? And go back to accumulated knowledge that perhaps we learned before we even understood what we were dealing with in terms of viruses.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, the bubonic plague was the root cause of the practice of quarantine, you know, the idea of the potential for a disease to move from person to person for whatever reason. And in the Middle Ages, they had very different ideas about how diseases worked. But that idea that maybe a disease could move from person to person or from item to item led to the idea of isolating anybody who seemed to be sick or isolating any goods that they were traveling with for a period of 40 days, hence the term quarantina. And so that practice itself goes back a long way. But often the practice of quarantine had to operate well in advance of the understanding of how diseases actually were transmitted. Mm. And that was still the case with bubonic plague even in 1900, that it was well understood that there were many ports around the Pacific and Indian Oceans that had cases of bubonic plague in the late 1890s. But in Australia, we were trying to quarantine any cases of it. The problem was we didn't still know, even in 1900, how it moved between people, or if it even moved between people, or if there was another factor involved entirely.
Yeah, and trying to piece this together was such a crucial thing. Robert, what can you add to this from sort of an immune perspective in terms of plague and so on?
Peter's right. Bubonic plague in 1900 in Sydney, which came in waves for the next 20 years, was an incredibly important disease in Australia. It was important because everyone feared it. It was on its way. It was the third great world pandemic, started in the same part of China that we think COVID-19 began, spread through Asia, and it was the first time it actually came to the New World, so to Australia and to America. And when it came, it infected people who worked around Darling Harbour. And Peter's absolutely right. Even though everybody in school now knows the rats and the fleas are involved, that was not clear at all in 1900. And in fact, medical management was based on not isolating the rat or getting rid of the rat or worrying about the flea. It was about isolating the patient. And as a result of that, it was calamitous. Anyone who got the disease, and over 300 people got it in the first wave, they would put into quarantine, and anyone living near them would be put in rowing boats and towed across Sydney Harbour so no one got near them. And a remarkable man called John Ashburton Thompson was the first person to really practically put together that there was, when the rat got sick, the flea, in a sense, left the rat, went on to the local human, and they became sick too. And that changed the whole idea of what was going on, and in fact was the basis of New South Wales Health developing so well in public health, in my view, that the public health, you've seen in terms of the management of COVID by New South Wales Public Health has been exemplary, probably the best in the world. And as it began with this particular man who set up doing exactly what we're doing with humans, except he was screening rats, 30 or 40,000 rats a year. And when rats started getting sick from the bubonic plague, he knew that the population was at sick. So he tested and isolated the rats and dropped both the cost of the next waves and the mortality absolutely dramatically by introducing this logical science-based management. And to me, this was the first great medical discovery in Australia and the impact it's had throughout the world in managing pandemics and many epidemics.
How interesting. And I guess what comes in here is the whole notion of public health as a thing that you can control and manage and how that works. John Ashburton Thompson came from Cambridge, from what I understand. And Peter, can you explain some of how his influence changed the way that we think about and manage public health? As Robert mentioned, the notion of, a state government taking responsibility, that wasn't something that we always did, was it?
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, the fact that Ashburton Thompson came from England said a lot too, that England had really been a leader in this idea of public health. In other words, that government bodies might have control over the health and welfare of citizens, and particularly in terms of reducing the spread of infectious diseases, but also improving their overall welfare, was a fairly English idea in the late 19th century. Hadn't been taken up nearly as much here in Australia, except really in terms of the convict system. And so he helped bring out ideas here, but really in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, health in Australia was largely managed, if it was managed at all, at the level of local councils.
Really?
And of course, yeah, and I mean, I don't ever want to talk down local councils. I think they played a very important role, but they were, of course, very disparate. They were quite different in their approaches, and some, you know, were quite strong and well-funded, and others were a bit laid back. And so Ashburton Thompson was one of those people, along with Professor Thomas Anderson Stewart at the University of Sydney, who really campaigned for a more centralised control over health, particularly in New South Wales. So in other words, giving the colonial government, which then went on to become the state government, more power to coordinate surveillance and what became epidemiology, you know, the science of studying how diseases are, or where they're located and how they spread, and also actually changing legislation to give more and more power to governments to intervene in the lives of citizens.
How interesting.
In order to protect the larger population. So the plague episode, I think, was an excellent case in point of how those powers played out in quite dramatic ways in Sydney.
That's fascinating when you live in a time when chief health officers really, who tend to stay in the background, they weren't household names, I guess, at the start of COVID-19, have really stepped to the fore as the people who get to make the decision in having this statutory role and all this public health legislation that I guess was sitting there waiting for this sort of scenario, and now has been brought out and allows governments to declare things quickly. And there's no parliamentary debate. They just get an expert to make the call, I guess, in this case.
I think the interesting thing too, Tom, is that when England developed its public health system, which was the beginning of the current health system in England, it was very much a non-medical development. It was through the engineers and the bureaucrats who were getting clean water and sewage control. And Ashburton Thompson began medical life as an obstetrician and learnt some of these, came to Australia probably because he had tuberculosis. Look, we gained a lot from English people coming here for the air, and he was one of them. And he was horrified, and he had the good fortune of having a brother who worked for the Sydney Morning Herald. And he would feed information to the brother, who would put it all in the newspapers and use that to get political leverage, and had an incredible impact of combining the addition of, if you like, the germ theory, which was still a very uncertain concept in the turn of the century. He combined the germ theory with the engineering ideas of sewage and water control, and used his brother to leverage a lot of these ideas, ranging from lead poisoning in children in Broken Hill, through to typhoid, tracing typhoid from dairies in Randwick. The most amazing things that this man came, and then he made his name really with the bubonic plague. So we owe a lot to John Ashburton Thompson.
Isn't it interesting? Whenever you start talking about history at home like this, you just see the things echoing through the years, the role of the media and public opinion and people getting worried, putting pressure on government. So that's been a big part of the story of 2020 as well. Indeed. This is Nightlife right around the country on ABC Radio. My name is Dom Knight in for Suzanne. We hope we'll return tomorrow. And we're talking about medical breakthroughs, public health, and some of the extraordinary discoveries made here in Australia. So John Ashburton Thompson and public health, and it sounds as though he really transformed things here. Were those ideas globally significant, Peter? Did he manage to, discover things that were influential overseas?
Yeah, I think the other thing we need to always remember here is that medicine and science are both international pursuits, and we certainly can make local achievements, but they often gain major traction by being spread internationally. And I think the pursuit of the plague and an attempt to actually resolve the problem of how it was transmitted and how it could be prevented was very much an international cast of stars in the 1890s and early 1900s as well. So Ashburton Thompson was one of a group, including a Russian called Alexander Yersin, who was working for the French and were working. And then there were also Japanese and French investigators all involved, as well as British investigators in India around 1890s and early 1900. And they all communicated with each other through international congresses and through publishing in the increasingly important medical journals of the time. So yes, Ashburton Thompson's work was really important to the way we managed public health in Sydney, and it certainly changed the way that we legislate about public health here. But his ideas really helped solidify this idea, as Robert said earlier, that plague wasn't necessarily a human disease. It was a disease that largely lived in small ground-dwelling animals and was transmitted between them by fleas. And it was only when the fleas ran out of live rat victims that they would feed on this rather poor substitute called a human.
Yeah,
Ashburton Thompson really drove that idea home internationally, and he was certainly well recognised and regarded for the quality of his science right through the 20th century on that basis.
You're hearing from Dr. Peter Hobbins. He's a historian of science, technology and medicine. And he's an honorary associate with the University of Sydney. Also, Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, who's a clinical immunologist, and he's got a book on the way, The Long Enlightenment, Australian Science from its Beginning to the Mid-20th Century. But before we move on to some of the other stories we're looking at, just this notion of public health, I'm fascinated by the idea of this, the Board of Health and these very powerful bureaucrats and people who are able to make these declarations. Robert, from your perspective, how important is this, bureaucratic infrastructure that Ashburton Thompson helped to develop?
Oh, I think incredibly important. And I actually only realised this when I saw the way it came together in the current COVID-19 in New South Wales. I was a professor of pathology at the medical school at Newcastle for 30 years, and we used to have training sessions for the expected pandemic. I mean, this has been something that's been instilled in the medical profession. It's not well known, it doesn't get publicized, but we all were aware of our roles and what we had to do if a major pandemic, and I guess the one we expected was going to be some form of avian flu or porcine flu, and then along comes COVID-19. So the idea of a pandemic coming was expected, just as Ashburton Thompson expected his bubonic plague. And so the influence on public health, and the way I see Ashburton Thompson was, at least in an Australian context, he was the medical addition to the engineering of having reticulated water supply and sewage disposal, the mechanical bits. And then that was, of course, we then developed the national system, through, again, a series of remarkable people, initially trained by Ashburton Thompson, and then you have people from important people from Melbourne, different parts of the country. And I think we've always had this high-level public health, and it was reflected in our contributions in World War One and World War Two through, again, remarkable people.
Yeah, I guess also the legacy of an Australia that has fairly well-developed public health systems and procedures for things like mass immunisation and some of the campaigns, certainly during my lifetime, the HIV campaigns, and the notion that the government steps in and that we listen and that we do what is recommended. And perhaps the legacy of all of these pioneers and the hard work that's been done in public health is why Australians were so responsive to the messaging that came out. And whereas in other countries, we won't go too far down that rabbit hole, but in other places, people were resistant to the expertise of authorities. Let's talk about another pioneer. We're going to jump forward in time to the 1940s and talk about Norman Gregg. Now, he was an ophthalmologist and an eye surgeon, but his most extraordinary contribution came in prenatal medicine, as we call it today. If we go back to the 1900s, what did we think about the role of outside factors in terms of pregnancy health? Do we really have the sense that what the expectant mother experienced and ingested and things like that would have an impact on the baby? Let's go to you on this, Peter.
Well, basically, no. I mean, I think that was one of the staggering insights that Norman Gregg was able to provide, but it was also one of the challenges he faced, was that really up until the 1940s, it was presumed that most birth defects were caused entirely by genetics, you know, by conditions inherent in one or both of the parents that were coming out in the child. So the idea that there might be some element of the environment, whether it was nutrition or infection, that might cause some problems in the unborn child was still relatively radical at the time, and that caused a fair bit of resistance to Gregg's ideas.
Right. So this whole, all the information you get when you've got a baby on the way about things you should and shouldn't do and all that sort of stuff, those were new ideas. Robert, tell us more about Norman Gregg. I understand he was a remarkable athlete as well as a scientific pioneer.
I hope my good friend Dr. Paul Lancaster is not listening, because Paul Lancaster is seriously the world expert on Norman Gregg. And knowing you wanted to talk to a bit about him, I actually asked Paul how long it took to get these ideas across. But the bottom line is that Norman Gregg was a remarkable man. There are some people in life who can do everything and anything extremely well, and he was one of those. He was a great sportsman. He could have represented Australia, I understand, even in tennis, cricket, and probably a few other sports.
Goodness.
He had a remarkable career in World War One. He came back and set himself up as an ophthalmologist, and he noticed, that was observation, that a number of the babies that he was seeing had eye defects and cataracts, and he took a history, and this was a thing we teach all our medical students: take a history, take a family history. And he did all of that, and he found that a number of the mothers had had what we know as rubella or German measles. And he put this together and published it in the Australian Medical Journal and some of the international ophthalmological journals. But it was such an out there idea that it took a long while before people cottoned on to the fact that this was so. And then a number of other very eminent Australians picked the idea up and consolidated the science and showed that there were defects in the brain, in hearing, and various other congenital problems that can come from intranatal infection with rubella. So Norman Gregg was a remarkable man who had powers of observation and did medicine very well, and was able to pick up on the idea. And I think that's the thing behind most great discoveries, that someone picks up on an idea when other people have not.
Yeah, isn't it interesting, the role of an open mind and seeing an association? And I mean, now I guess if there was a problem that people were discovering in newborns or young children, you would think to look at, you know, was there something in the experience of the mother while she was pregnant and trying to make a link there. But I can completely understand that if no one had even conceived of the notion that any experience of a pregnant woman could affect the health of the child, that must have been a very hard message to sell. Isn't that fascinating? Peter, I guess it goes to show the value of, as we heard from Robert, listening, but also just having the sort of brain that notices associations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe Norman Gregg, one of his offsiders, heard him exclaim, "I've got it," when he was sort of pacing up and down in the hospital. And he'd suddenly made that connection, and he could see that there was this link between infection with what has always been a relatively mild disease, rubella.
Yeah.
I mean, generally it doesn't cause a lot of problems in the people who are actually suffering from it. And this series of defects that he happened to be able to notice because he was an eye specialist. But of course, it's one thing to say, "I've got it." Many of us think we have these brilliant insights. The thing was that he was actually right. And so he had to be, convinced of his rightness and then find ways to prove it. And Robert mentioned our joint friend, Paul Lancaster. Well, Paul's father, Oliver Lancaster, was a world-leading epidemiologist. You know, he was a real guru in health statistics, and he actually also contributed to the success of Norman Gregg's work by being able to show, statistically that this correlation wasn't just by accident or, mere coincidence, but that there was actually a genuine cause and effect going on there between a pregnant mother's picking up German measles and an increased likelihood of birth defects in their children. And, we can often say, say 1,000 people who've been given an influenza vaccine go on to develop influenza. So surely it's causing the influenza. Well, you say, but if you vaccinated 1,000,000 people and only 1,000 of them actually came down with the disease, maybe they already had been infected before they had their immunization. So proving that cause and effect is the harder yards, I guess, from having that flash of insight, the "I've got it" moment.
Yeah, and the importance of clinical skills. One doctor I know always stresses the notion that communication skills are one of the key attributes of successful doctors, and this story certainly seems to illustrate that he got the histories and was able to talk about this and get all this sort of stuff. So, Robert, in terms of observing and making these connections, there are some other examples of Australian doctors making these incredible connections and making medical history with their observations.
Absolutely. It's interesting that these days, when you're looking at a pregnant woman, you're concerned about external factors, and infection is one. And the second, of course, is drugs. The idea that a medication could cause some form of defect in a developing baby wasn't even thought about until Australians recognised thalidomide caused birth defects. And this was a hugely different sort of concept and idea. And, we Australians have therefore had great contributions in the whole area of outside factors affecting development and birth. And again, because I think of observation and that capacity to stand outside and see a connection.
How interesting. Let's move on to another revolutionary notion. Let's talk about John Cade and the use of lithium in treating mental health disorders. Who was John Cade, Robert?
John Cade is my best friend, and his father is the John Cade you're talking about.
Yes, there's a John Cade known as Jack Cade, isn't there?
Jack Cade, yeah. Well, I call him John because everyone else calls him Jack. But I was hoping you'd get him on tonight, because he himself is a remarkable Australian physician.
Yeah, we had a few difficulties connecting with him today, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear the story. But
I can understand.
I'm sure you can substitute for us.
Jack, I can understand that. But,
no dramas.
His father, I had the good, John and I worked, John Jr. and I worked together at McMaster University. And when his father got the equivalent to the Nobel Prize in psychiatry, he came to America to collect his prize, and we had dinner at John Jr.'s place. And he told the story of how he discovered it. And it's one of the most remarkable pieces of information. Very briefly, he came back from World War II, having been interned through that, and decided to become a psychiatrist. And he believed that psychiatry was going to be a chemical disease, not a Freudian type disease due to experience and psychological type factors, which was very different to the way everyone was thinking of psychiatric disease. So he took a bipolar disease, which goes up and down, as everybody knows, in terms of depression or mania. And he said, let's take the urine, where if there's a chemical cause, there'd be something excreted in the urine. So he took the urine and injected it into mice. And he found that when he did that from a manic patient, the mouse sort of went clonk, you know, and had a psychiatric depression. And so he thought, well, there must be something in urine. So he said, well, what's there? And they said, uric acid. And so he found a soluble urate, which was lithium urate, because there's not many soluble urates. And then although he wasn't trained so much in science, he said, well, I better do a control by using some other lithium salt, like lithium chloride, and found exactly the same effect in mice. And then he tested himself, which I understand nearly sent his wife crazy.
Oh, goodness.
Because he was filling himself up with lithium carbonate or chloride. And then he gave it to a patient. And that patient had been in a straitjacket, which was the way manic patients were treated, sadly, in those days. And the patient underwent a dramatic improvement and was discharged, because no one actually thought, well, maybe you've got to keep the treatment going.
Oh.
And within the next week, the patient was back for some more lithium. And that's the beginning of lithium and beginning of chemical treatment of psychiatric disease. And lithium, many of my psychiatrist friends will say today, lithium is still the very best mood-changing drug that we have.
I know people who've had that transform their lives. What an extraordinary thing.
So we all have friends like that, yeah.
A few beeps here and there because we're using fancy apps and so on to get a better sound quality. And I must say, both of our guests sound fabulous, so we're happy to put up with that. But Dr. Peter Hobbins and Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, who you've just heard from, telling us about medical breakthroughs in Australia here on Nightlife. My name's Dom Knight, filling in for... for Suzanne. So an extraordinary discovery there, really, with the lithium. And even the notion of it being a chemical cause, and we talk now about brain chemistry and all the hormones and all the things sort of sloshing around in there that affect our mood and so on. But I guess, Peter, traditionally it had been a talking cure, hadn't it? The notion of that you can converse and get to problems in people's lives and so on that they're able to address, and that's still part of the mix. But it's ways of new ways of thinking that seem to be driving some of these developments, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, really, you go back to the 19th century and psychiatry, what we would now call psychiatrists were often called alienists because they were seen to be, dealing with creatures who were rather different from us, not in a science fiction sort of way, but simply that people had been alienated and were strange. And their cure was very much a moral approach at the time. It was actually seen to emanate from the forcefulness and the power of example over control of mind and body that the doctor projected before we moved at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century with the Freudian idea that there were many suppressed urges and memories within us that needed to be released and talked through, that classic Freudian talking cure that took a long time to gain acceptance in Australia. And in fact, it was only really just starting to be taken up at the same time that John Cade was making his lithium insights as well. So there was a little bit of a balance going on there, because really for a lot of Australian doctors, psychiatry or even psychology was seen rather as distasteful mumbo jumbo right up into the 1930s and even into the war neuroses of the 1940s. There were many doctors who were still dubious about whether people's minds were truly disordered or whether they were basically malingering and trying to get out of things that they didn't like doing.
What an interesting thing. So that's had a huge legacy too. Now, back in time to some products that were enormously popular in Australian homes. Maybe you remember this from the 60s.
Stop your headache and that pain is good advice. It's brief. Take the incense with confidence for quick three-way relief.
Take Vincent's, or perhaps this.
Why don't you have a Bex with your cup of tea?
Relieve your aches and pains with Bex.
Bex is better.
Yeah, Bex cup of tea and a lie down. And Kevin Rudd used to like telling people to have a Bex if they were asking questions. We've only 4 minutes from the news, unfortunately. We're going to have to defer some things to next week. We've had so much fun finding out about all this. But these powders, Bex and Vincent's and the like, the headache powders, were fairly extraordinary. Peter, what actually was in this stuff?
Well, they were often called APC mixtures, which meant aspirin, phenacetin and caffeine. Now, that sounds great. You know, wow, it takes away aches and pains, gives you a little buzz at the same time. And that's exactly what it did for many, many Australians, particularly women, although certainly not exclusively them as well. So, you know, aspirin we still know and you can still buy it today as a painkiller. Phenacetin actually was taken off the market around the world in the 1970s and 1980s, partly because it did enormous damage to the kidneys if taken regularly and in large doses. And caffeine, I don't need to say much about, except that if you've got a drug mixture that has an addictive substance in it that causes painful withdrawal symptoms when you suddenly take it away, you can start to see how these powders, which people just mixed up and had as a little pep-me-up, you can see how they became quite popular, sort of irrespective of any potential medical use. They were just seen as a bit of a tonic, really.
Yeah, in terms of a lifestyle perspective too. And Robert, I understand your wife used to work in a pharmacy. Was this stuff that was one of the most popular products?
I think it was being sold not just in pharmacies but over the counter everywhere. It was the way to go. As Peter said, it was partly addictive. Many women were literally addicted to it. And it was a serious cause. It used to cause necrosis or death of part of the drainage system of the kidneys. And it was a significant cause of morbidity and mortality.
And we have Dr. Priscilla Kincaid-Smith to thank for discovering some problems with these, don't we?
Yeah, she was a remarkable lady. I worked at the Royal Melbourne Hospital when I was with the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute many years ago, and she was two floors up, but her impact certainly went more than two floors. She was a very influential, powerful, impressive person, ended up becoming the president of the Royal Society of Royal College of Physicians, and rightly so. She ran the renal unit with rigor and vigor and really was influential in drawing attention to and reversing the usage of APC.
There you go. Now, we were going to get on to Barry Marshall and Helio back to Paori, Nobel Prize winning research, but we're going to have to defer that to next week. I've just learnt so much about the way that research works, and I had no idea that we discovered so many things in the past. It's been a fascinating journey. Also, the notion of applied research versus some of the more blue sky things that we've been doing. So we're going to have chapter two of this conversation next week here on Nightlife on Monday night. And look, Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my great pleasure.
His book coming out soon is The Long Enlightenment, Australian Science from Its Beginning to the Mid-20th Century. And Dr. Peter Hobbins, who's a historian and an honorary associate at Sydney Uni. Peter, thank you so much for your contribution.
Always delighted to join you. Thanks, Dom.
And yeah, it's been a lovely hour here, our first hour on Nightlife.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.